Education and General Government. Welcome to everyone. You have an agenda. If you do, we are going to go out of order. And we're going to start first with a report on full-day kindergarten and the implementation committee that's underway. And Morgan Allen from the Department of Education. This has to do with the Senate Bill 44 that we passed, and we're moving forward. Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen with the Oregon Department of Education here to give a report on the full-day kindergarten implementation committee. And just to remind the committee, this is a result of the passage of Senate Bill 44, which was Senator Hass's bill during the last legislative session. And I probably don't need to remind this committee, but if you remember, during the 2007 legislative session, there was a family that raised the issue of whether or not it was appropriate and legal for school districts to be charging tuition for their full-day kindergarten programs. And I think many of us know that a lot of school districts in Oregon have been doing that for 25 or 30 years. And our agency sought and received an opinion from the Attorney General's office that said that was not okay. And during the February 2008 special session, we passed Senate Bill 1068, which allowed school districts to continue charging tuition through the 2009-10 school year with the anticipation that during the 2009 session we'd all be able to come back and figure out how to solve this problem. And then, as you all know, the bad economy and the recession, depression hit. And so we came up with a compromise in Senate Bill 44, which extended the allowance of districts to charge tuition for a couple more years through the 2011-12 school year, and came up with the full-day kindergarten implementation committee. Essentially, this committee, it's appointed by the superintendent of public instruction, and the Department of Education is staffing it. Myself and Catherine Heaton at our agency, who's an early childhood kindergarten expert, are going to be providing staffing to the committee. Essentially, the committee is charged with two things. The first is to be able to provide information to school districts on what are the best ways and resources available to if they're interested in implementing full-day kindergarten for their school districts. And the second thing is a report to the interim legislative education committees by October 1st of 2010 with a recommendation or recommendations about funding methods for getting full-day kindergarten implemented and funded by the 2012-13 school year. If you remember, towards the end of session, we had a lot of debate about this. You know, some of our friends like Ozzie Rose and others came in with some ideas, phase-ins and things like that, and that's part of what this committee is going to be charged with looking at. So the committee has been organized. We did have our first meeting on November 9th. I've included a handout with a bunch of information related to the task force and some of the things that went out to the committee. We have actually, if you look at the third page, that's the membership of the committee. And we have 11 folks representing, I think, a pretty good balance of we have administrators, school principals, teachers, people with full-day kindergarten or early childhood experience, superintendents. We have folks from Head Start. And actually, I don't know if any of you know Colette Peters. She's the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And so she's joining our committee as someone who's interested in how early childhood education can help turn kids around. We have parent representation on this committee as well. Karen Twain, who's actually come to this committee and testified on this topic before, she's a principal at Metzger Elementary and Tiger Tewalt and is going to be our committee chair. And then Valerie Sebesta, who's with the Oregon Education Association's Center for Teaching and Learning, is serving as our committee vice chair. Again, we did have our first meeting about a week or so ago on November 9th, and, you know, frankly, there was a lot of pro forma stuff. We went through the rules, reviewed the bill, elected our chairs, you know, had a lot of questions. But substantively, I think the committee got off to a really good start. It's very clear that these 11 folks and our legislative advisors are committed to figuring out solutions to this issue and how to move forward with full-day kindergarten in Oregon. Not surprisingly, lots of the same questions that we've heard in this committee and over in the House were raised: equity, funding, how to deal with capital needs, what are other states doing, what are best practices, what does the research show. We're going to be having our next meeting in January, and the committee gave us direction to bring in folks that are sort of finance experts and get some superintendents from a representative sample of school districts across Oregon who have full-day kindergarten, who have implemented full-day kindergarten, sort of hear their stories, how they went about doing it, some firsthand experience when it was coupled with the experiences of the folks on the committee. So with that, we did have an excellent first meeting. And the other thing just to point out, included in the packet, is the last three pages, we provided some data to the full-day implementation committee. And some of this has been provided to this committee before, but it basically just shows the growth in full-day kindergarten, in especially the last 5 or 6 years in Oregon. Basically now, one out of three kindergartners in Oregon in the 2008-2009 school year was in a full-day program, and whether the school districts were figuring out how to make that work with their school improvement fund or their state school fund dollars or by charging tuition or using their Title I monies, a lot of districts are going the extra mile to try to figure out how to do this. It's very popular with parents and students. We've heard that over and over and over from members of the committee who have it in their district, that you know, sometimes there's some reluctance and concern on the part of parents, but once they make the switch, people get very grumpy when school districts look at going back the other direction. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Thank you. I was at the first meeting, and there were some very good education minds there. Karen Twain is the principal of Metzger, which was the school, Oregon School of the Year 2 years ago.
And I can see why.
She credits full-day kindergarten a couple years prior to that as to how they became so successful. And they did full-day kindergarten without any extra money. Space was a problem, but they figured out how to do it anyway. And anyway, so she's a real talent, and I'm glad she's chairing this, and glad to see this is going as planned. It was a, for the record, committee bill, by the way. Questions, Morgan?
When will we have the date?
Actually, I'll email it to you. There's an email that should be coming out next week, in the next week or so, with hopefully minutes transcribed from the first meeting and information, and we do have a date and a time, so we'll be sending that out very soon.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'll let you off to your next mission.
I'd rather stay here.
Is it that bad where you're going? You'd rather stay in a legislative committee
meeting? House education.
Oh, House. Oh, yeah. I
understand. We're close that informational meeting. And we are fortunate today to have a presentation on expanded learning time, not just year-round, but longer days, lengthened school years. And from New York, we've invited out Furman Brown. If you want to come up, Mr. Brown, from Generation Schools. And he's been looking at this upside down and backwards for a long time, and he has some great information on how, essentially, without scooping him, leveraging resources that exist now into keeping kids in school longer and in a more effective and comprehensive way. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I actually get to spend a lot of time in Oregon. It's a place that I greatly enjoy, so it's fun to be back here.
Maybe if you could start off just kind of giving us an overview of your organization.
Sure. I run a nonprofit organization called...
And your name for the record.
My name is Furman Brown, for the record. I run a nonprofit organization. It's based in Brooklyn, New York, called Generation Schools. We are committed to the notion that there's lots of possibility with the resources that already exist within schools, and that if we sort of fundamentally rethink how we've organized them, that we can accomplish much more. We've been working with the Department of Education in New York City, Chancellor Klein and his team from the Innovation Office, and the United Federation of Teachers to implement a brand new model for how to operate an urban public school within the system. Our model has a 200-day school year and a 7-hour school day that doesn't increase the teacher's work year by even a minute by staggering when teachers' vacations occur and trading time for time. Our teachers teach longer instructional days, but we've built into their work year approximately 20 to 22 professional development days that are shorter. And in the balance of the year, that time equals the same number of minutes that any teacher within the city of New York would work. As a result, we don't have to charge more, and the school doesn't cost more. What you're looking at is the New York figures. So the numbers are obviously higher than what many districts around the country spend on schools, and it's based on a charter school model. On the inside is the budget. We presented a charter version of the budget simply because it's easier to, it's a much more straightforward budgeting process. But we are actually a public school and not a charter school in New York City. We designed the model of, to be either or. For us, it's public school is a public school, and it really is our intent to sort of just create a new way to organize people, space, and time. Our first school is a high school. It's based in Brooklyn Generation, or Brooklyn, it's called Brooklyn Generation, and it's in one of those large comprehensive high schools that the city has worked to sort of transform into small schools. I know they've done similar work in Portland. And New York has actually been a fairly successful process, though certainly not without a lot of pain, sharing campuses. Phasing out and sort of moving into someone's campus while you're moving in is like moving into someone's home that's been foreclosed while they're still living there. And there's a lot of sort of pain that goes along with that process. But that said, we've had tremendous success in the first 2 years. We're now in the third year of the school. Our school serves a community. It's a primarily African-American school with about 80% of the students eligible for free or reduced lunch. It's been a campus that's struggled for a very long time with serious gang issues. So the city targeted is one of its worst 1%, where they sort of shut down the campus. It's got 16 police officers in the building at all times. The chancellor framed it as unsalvageable and so moved in new small schools, and we're one of those new schools. We've maintained an 85% attendance rate in a campus where kids did not want to come for a long time. It's a 200-day school year with no air conditioning in New York City, so you can imagine what that can be like. And we've been thrilled that the kids have continued to come and that the teachers have continued to be excited about the process. What we've done in terms of organizing the schools, we've rethought not only when teachers work, but how they work and who they work with. In essence, we've taken the entire staff and created dual teaching roles. So if we were all teaching at the school, we would by and large teach two foundation courses in the morning with class sizes averaging 14 to 1, which is about half the average in New York City. By having all of us sort of all hands on deck in the morning teaching core courses, we're able to do that. In the afternoon, each of us would then teach one what we call a studio course, and it could be a wide variety of electives. Additional required courses, mandated services, that sort of thing. That combination of all hands on deck in the morning and sort of diverse services in the afternoon allows us to have a really flexible day. It's longer for the students, again, without increasing the work year for the teachers. In fact, we're able to create 2 hours of common planning time every day for every teaching team. So the four teachers who might be teaching ninth grade algebra, for instance, to two sets of kids classes in the morning, have 2 hours every day in the afternoon where they can debrief what the day was like, what were we intending, what was accomplished, who you know got it, who didn't, what is the data telling us, and that is an important part of our day. In addition to that, we have a team of teachers that staggers to each grade level twice a year. We call them our intensive course teachers, fully certified, full-time teachers who are teach, in essence, humanities courses. It's reading, writing, sort of woven through college and career guidance. Right now, our 10th grade students are taking intensive courses on medical, careers, forensics. We have sports management, and I'm forgetting the fourth one right now. And students pick just one course, and that's their course for the day. They're out of the building largely for that month. They're exploring college campuses and workplace opportunities within that field, and they're also producing some project are within that field. Our medical students, for instance, are producing a health fair for the campus next week. While those 10th grade students are in their intensive courses, the 10th grade teachers are on vacation. So right now our 10th grade teachers are not at the school. They're on vacation for 3 weeks. For the fourth week, they'll come back but not work with students. They'll actually work with each other on a grade level team. Again, those days are shorter, even though the teaching days are longer. And then that's how we get expanded learning time without increasing the cost by even a dollar in terms of teacher costs.
What does a summer vacation look like for the students?
For students, around 4 or 5 weeks, depending upon some students have a sort of expanded tutoring that we extend, but for the average student, it's about a month.
Do they all take it at the same time, August somewhere?
So our school year starts middle of August and ends at the end of June, and so that interim time is when most students have vacation. We have summer school options and summer employment options for students that are just a part of the broader New York City school system. But for our school, it's that time is off. For athletes, we create opportunities for them to. It's one of the things that we're working out within the campus. It's a shared campus, and we have shared athletics. So we decided to keep athletics a campus-wide opportunity, even though we have small schools. So that's one of the quirks. If our school is operating a different time and a longer day, what do we do for athletes? And we've created strategies. Since we have more time, we have more credits, more flexibility, that it's easier for us to say, okay, the athletes during football season that are athletes won't have to take the last period as a studio course. They can join the football team with the rest of the students. And the same sort of thing happens in the summer.
What is the grades are we talking about here?
Right now we're at 9th through 11th grade. The 12th graders are still the old school. We'll be the full high school next year, and then we will grow down in that building 6th through 12. Our model was designed to be a K through 12 model that would work, you know, PK through 12 actually. Similarly, at any grade range. We started at high school because of the Gates grants in New York City sort of made that the priority. Now that that has that time has sort of passed for New York City, they're open to really sort of middle and elementary school within their new school startup focus. New York's focused on the bottom 10% of their schools. There are 1,400 public schools in New York City, so that it's an immense challenge. And the bottom 10% reflects 140 schools that they're working to replace, and so we're part of that process.
Somehow I get this impression that where teachers are kind of like it's like an old Tony Curtis movie or something, running from one party to the next and just, you know, balancing trays.
They just teach three courses a day. If you think about it, in the morning I come in, if I'm a teacher, an algebra teacher, I have a class, I have 90 minutes, I have a bank of six computers, and I have 14 kids. I plan for that experience. It's quite a different experience. After 90 minutes, there's a 15-minute break. And then I have another group of kids for 14 kids for 90 minutes. And then I teach one class in the afternoon. That's my day in terms of working with students. The rest of the time I'm working with professionals and preparing for it. So it's actually a really calm, organized, simple model. It's just quite different. But when you go in, the chancellor came on Monday and was just surprised at how it still looks like a school. The classrooms look different when you have fewer kids and bank of six computers. You can think very differently how to approach instruction. And for teachers who are ready for that moment, it's been amazing to watch them teach. For others, it's a big shift. It's been a hard shift. I'm still standing in front of a chalkboard with 90 minutes and 14 kids. You know, I need to shift out of that. And that's for some teachers that got very good at 45 minutes, five periods a day. That's been a big shift, and that's part of why we have 20 days of staff development and 2 hours of common planning time built into every work year to help folks make that shift. But it's anything but a sort of a three-ring circus.
Yeah. And how are you measuring the success here? I realize you don't have a long track record.
We have four data points that the city looks at. Attendance is one of them. Credit accumulation is another one at the high school level. Third one is what they call the Regents tests in New York City, or the statewide tests. And then the fourth one is student selection. Are students choosing to go to that campus? In terms of attendance, we've maintained 85% attendance. Again, that's a high number for the area where we've served for the entire time that the school's operated. We ranked number one in our standardized test scores. They compare you to 40 similar schools in the district. That's how they measure you, sort of rank you. And we were number one in test scores. We were number two in attendance and number five in credit accumulation. Our model with extra time that you have and sort of the flexibility of the mornings being separate from the afternoons, great flexibility for credit recovery. Once kids fall behind in a foundation course, we can create a studio course immediately that helps kids catch up. They're scheduled separately. It's the same teachers teaching in the morning that would teach in the afternoon, so it's an easier to sort of plan for what kids might need in the afternoon. That's helped us ensure that kids don't fall behind. It's helped our special needs students and our ELL students stay on track for on-time graduation. The fourth data point is our kids choosing to come. Our building was the most avoided high school campus of any high school in New York City for a decade. The building holds 6,000 kids, if you can imagine that. And they had only 1,600 when the chancellor announced that they were going to be a phase-out campus. This year, and for our first 2 years, we had a hard time getting parents to want to send their kids to a college readiness campus in a building with 16 cops. This year, we exceeded our enrollment goal by 15%, and 80% of those kids picked us in their top three of 12 choices. So for us, that's a very exciting data point. We're still early, obviously, in our proof of concept. We have every data point that we can look at, we're pretty pleased with at this point.
The intuitive knowledge, in addition to the research, is that the longer kids spend in school, the better they do, and I guess you're seeing that borne out.
We would say if it's more of the same and they weren't doing well in a structure that's not organized well, that you won't likely see large gains. But when you have more time and it's organized in a way where teachers can be more effective, teachers can be more planful, teachers have more time to look at data and respond to it, and then teachers have more time with far fewer students, we're seeing quick turnarounds with students. Even the teachers that aren't sort of transforming practice pedagogically yet are having a much easier time at just the basics of managing kids and getting to know kids. Even if it's uncomfortable to know how to manage groups of kids doing different things, just having 14 to 16 kids instead of 30 makes a substantial difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. This is very interesting. You answered my first question. I was going to ask you about if you have such small classes, did you have a space issue? But apparently not if you're in a building that holds 6,000 students. So I think that's a concern with schools that are already full. If they anything that lowers class sizes, there's nowhere to put the students.
Most buildings have lots of rooms that are sort of specialized classrooms. We designed the model so it would work within the normal enrollment patterns in the normal space. So we happen to be in a unique situation, but once all of the schools are filled, we're not going to get any more space than we would otherwise. Some of the larger rooms, it's easy to divide with a simple retrofitting of a sort of movable divider down the middle. We use other rooms like art rooms and music rooms, and because the same people teaching in the mornings that would teach in the afternoons, we use all of the spaces for sort of the core courses in the afternoon. So picture a library that can hold two or three groups in the morning, sort of divided in a way that sound is not a problem, that uses space more efficiently. Picture a large classroom that's subdivided for, most large classrooms hold 36 to 40 kids in New York City. So those rooms can easily hold, can be divided in two and hold groups of 20. In the afternoons when the class size is larger, you can push the divider apart if necessary. But space, we knew we needed to plan a model that would work in current space, within current budget confines, and it had to sort of work within the basic parameters of the teacher's contract. But that was about it. We sort of then sort of let ourselves think more freely about people, space, and time. We've worked diligently with the union for 3 years. Our thin contract is really just when the start date and the end date of the school year happens. That was the only thing we actually had to change in the teacher's contract. It said it starts at like Memorial Day, ends at Labor Day. That was it. The rest we were able to manage through a site-based agreement, just the teachers at the school selecting how the day was organized differently.
Follow-up question. So did you or do you recruit teachers specifically for this model, or did you work with the teachers who were already at the school?
When you move into a phase-out building in New York City, it's a little of both. The union and the city have negotiated a process where you have to consider 50% of your new spaces for the staff that are already there. Because our calendar year worked different and the school was untested, we actually didn't have any teachers from the original school apply. So for us, that wasn't a challenge. The union wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity for teachers to have a escape hatch, as they call it, so that if it didn't work, if they tested out this very different model and found out this just wasn't going to work for them, that there was a clause that enabled them to go back to their old job. And no teacher actually took that after the first year. But it was something that made it much easier for people to sort of test the waters. Because it is a new school and not a conversion school, we were able to sort of pick from a very large talent pool in New York City folks who were interested in trying something different. After the first year, the union and the city expanded the agreement, so it's a three-year agreement now that's just sort of auto-renews, but the teachers have to, we have to have a majority vote of faculty support each year. The escape hatch no longer exists from the union and the city's perspective, that people now have, there's data, they can come see what the school looks like, they can see how the day is organized, so that if they choose to come there, then they're making a choice based upon information that's available.
Thank you. One more follow-up question. I noticed that you have a cost comparison with a charter school allotment per pupil. It's very close, $12,000. You have $12,300, mm-hmm. and the cost comparison with the state, $12,400. How is your school funding allocated? Does it vary by district? Obviously, expenses are higher in the city area, right, as opposed to rural New York.
Right.
So how does that compare with the rest of the state?
The charter number is fairly consistent. New York City actually spends, the way it works in the district is that principals now have much more control over their budgets than they used to, so it's no longer an FTE budget model. It's a real dollar budget model, more charter-like. They get about $10,000 of a per pupil funding, roughly, that they're in control of, and then the remainder, which is $14,000 total in the city. I've given you the charter sort of version. The city actually gets more, but is accountable for more services. So in New York City, you have roughly $14,000 per pupil. The way they've organized their budget structure is that they have a base amount that every student every person is valued at, and then they have, based upon need and other figures,
adjustments.
Yeah. So the school budget can vary greatly within New York City. That's why we picked the charter version, just to share to sort of give a sense of how the budget works in general.
Thank you.
Do you have any thoughts on what is more effective, a longer day or a longer year, or do they complement each other?
I think both matter. What the longer year gets for us is the opportunity to really have those intensive courses, which by far that's what the students talk about most when they go to recruit new students. It's a chance to get out of the building and really study some career for an extended period of time. So our guidance program is an 1,100-hour program. You know, most high schools, you get to spend an hour or so with your guidance counselor, you know, junior year while you're filling out forms. And for us, we wanted it to be an integral part of every kid's experience. So twice a year in ninth grade, twice a year in 10th grade, 11th grade, and so on, that's a part of their life. We wouldn't be able to have that if we didn't have the longer day, or the longer year, rather. We also wouldn't be able to have the level of professional development that we have if we didn't have the longer school year. I think for families, having a month more of school has proven, people were worried about that, what are families going to do if, you know, child care issues. Having most kids in a safe place for an extra month that families don't actually have to pay for has proven to be something that's been very positive.
The kids are receptive to that?
Kids won't say they like a longer year, but they say they love the college and career program, and they come. You know, all the other schools let out June 28th. We initially had ended later and started at the same time. Now we've shifted that. So they don't necessarily like starting when none of the other schools have started, but they come. They know it's a special. The college and career program is pretty remarkable for them. And the class size is another piece in our model that it's hard to disentangle what's actually most important. When you've got more time with just 14 kids, you really, as a teacher, get to know them. Kids don't fall through the cracks. You know them not only as learners, but as people. And kids talk about that a lot. They're like, you know, our teachers know and care about us.
Well, I know that's just from talking to you previously, there's a tough neighborhood in Brooklyn. And for some reason, I've been humming "Welcome Back, Cotter" theme since I've been up here. I know that you've achieved some national recognition, or at least been the focus of a couple of studies. Could you comment on that?
Sure. In fact, yesterday we were in Washington, D.C. for the release of the Center for American Progress did a study on expanded learning time initiatives that were district-based and not charter-based. They were able to find lots of examples of charter schools that have longer days and years, but not many, actually, that were district-based with sort of the union as slot partners. In fact, they only found three that they felt they could report on. We were one, an initiative out of Buffalo Public Schools, which it was the second, and then an initiative in Boston that involved citizen schools, which is sort of an after-school program that has woven in through the day, were the three groups that they focused on. I can forward the link to the white paper. I think I did forward you the link today to the white paper. And there's a webcast on there as well, which has, for our project, the Vice President from the United Federation of Teachers speaks about the process we went through, and I think his comments are particularly interesting about what needed to happen in order to really push thinking for a typical system in terms of how people's day and how people's year was organized. For us, it's been very exciting. So 15 years, it was 10 years in development, and another 5 years to actually get sort of the political will to try something within the system. We will probably have a mix of charter schools and public schools. We can actually get an 8-hour school day without increasing the work year and without increasing costs, but that was a bit much to try to push initially and is easier for us to test as a charter. But our real goal is to work with urban districts or districts in general on pushing thinking about how we've typically organized schools. We've thought differently about special needs. We've thought differently about virtually every aspect of a school. But we still have to be in compliance. We still have to follow all the state regs. We had to sort of think very carefully about No Child Left Behind and all the sorts of things that every public school has to think of. We do as well. We're just accounting for them differently. And so CAP, the Center for American Progress, focused on that. Education Sector out of D.C. published a white paper a few weeks ago about our human capital innovations and how teachers are responding to a different workplace. And then we recently received a multi-year grant from the Ford Foundation. It's a planning grant initially that will lead to multi-year funding from the Ford Foundation to expand the work both in New York and nationally.
If you are recommending this model to states like, say, Oregon, would you recommend getting your toe wet and lengthening the day, 10 minutes, a little bit here, and a day here, or would you say, recommend districts starting a pilot like yours, or how?
What we're planning on doing is having a combination, having full partner schools that we're testing and growing more slowly that test a full model, which is a fairly radical departure on our level, so we get that the proof of concept will be important for any district that wants to test it. But then we're also working on affiliate schools that can test different types of expanded learning time strategies. Part of our work for years is really testing all different kinds of models. For us, we ultimately decided what we really want is to have something that not only adds more time, but dramatically decreases class size. So for us, both of those things matter. We know that that's a major shift. There are many ways to get more class time without increasing costs that are sort of the toe in the water. So we're calling those affiliate partners, and we're creating room for both. And I think that the National Center for Time and Learning out of Boston is another resource that you can turn to that has ideas that are maybe smaller steps. At the same time, I think part of the problem of urban education in particular is that it's been lots of piecemeal, small steps that don't actually fit together, and that's what's led to high cost with limited impact. We talk about the Rubik's Cube a lot. Education is a paradigm is a complex beast, and most of us can play with the Rubik's Cube and get the yellow side to look nice, but then when you turn it around, you're like, oh my goodness. Getting the whole thing to work for us is what matters. If you look at piecemeal reforms over the years, they tend to be add-on, which adds cost and complexity without necessarily accomplishing the goals. So we really encourage folks to sort of not settle on just the toe in the water, because it sounds like, you can't change the system. We hear that all the time, you can't change the system, or the union will ever participate, or things that sort of let you off the hook from trying to think broadly. And
you've been listening in to our hearings?
Yeah, I mean, it's common. But it's quite possible. That's what's been very exciting, is that it's working. It's working at cost. Kids are happy. Teachers are happy. And we've got a lot to prove yet, but for us to actually see the pieces fit, to see that it actually can work, and we're in one of the toughest. We were not exactly happy to be placed where we were placed. We're also a mile away from the last subway stop on the 2 train, and 2 months of our year for every kid is all over the city. For us, it was that alone was a logistical challenge. But we're thrilled to be there now, and we're thrilled to actually sort of demonstrate in a very difficult situation that not only will teachers' unions be great thought partners, and for us they have been, not only can districts be changed substantially, but we'll join you in thought partnerships. And in New York City, things like cutting paychecks at a different time is a big deal. They loved the idea of a 200-day school year, but the union was like, we don't mind teachers starting early, but we don't want them waiting for 2 months to get paid. That was reasonable. That, for us, was like, you're right. They shouldn't be. And the city was the same way. Like, yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. What can we do? So part of what the nonprofit did was look for what we call bridges. There's an emergency check-cutting strategy that we can use for now while we test it to see if it's like, now that it's worked, the city's actually looking to change their whole system so that it can become more nimble to all kinds of innovations that may need to cut checks at different times. So if you just do the toe in the water, you don't actually get to the systematic changes that may be needed for more powerful reform.
I have another question. In the other schools where you mentioned they had extended, you said Buffalo, Boston, and your school, do they have this comparable per student funding? We'd like to have that much funding.
I know. I knew that was going to be. Actually, when I came, I wanted Portland to be the first district school. Actually, I do spend a lot of time here. And when Vicki Phillips was actually the superintendent and they were going through major thinking about K-8 schools, we were here. But the timing just, there were so many changes happening at that point that we were just, it was the wrong time. But we had designed it so that it could work at a $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 per pupil funding. It may not be as small a class sizes. You may not have as many robust programs. I was back here this summer and just reintroducing myself and sort of looking at Portland's budget. And it would work, it would look slightly different, but would work clearly, not every state's going to spend $12,000 per pupil. They can't. We actually believe there isn't more money for public school funding, given change in demographics. People push back on us all the time with that statement, but I think that as the economy changes and as our nation, the demographics of the nation ages, that it's going to be difficult to expect more money for public school funding. So our real goal is to, well, how can we double the value of what we already have? We cut class size in half and expand learning time by 30% without asking for more money. That to us is a pretty powerful demonstration project.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Yeah. Senator Cruz? Are you utilizing any virtual curricula?
Not yet, but largely just because the technology in the building where we are, it doesn't really allow for that, but our goal is to...
It would fit, I would
think. Yeah. So our banks of computers are, like, the wireless in the building doesn't work real well, and the power is questionable. But you can imagine it fitting in pretty easily.
Can I ask a follow-up? I assume a website where we could get more information about the actual structure of, like, the teacher's schedules and that kind of thing, just to take a look at that?
And we don't have a lot on the website, but I'd be glad to send more information.
Okay, well, email.
And I'll be here for the next couple of weeks, too, and coming back to Oregon fairly regularly. The Ford Foundation sort of asking us to sort of put together what our growth plan is, and Oregon's a state I care a lot about, so I'm hoping that we can find a way to sort of work here.
I'd be particularly interested in seeing a little bit more detail about the schedule, and particularly the teacher's schedule and how that works.
Thank you, and congratulations on your innovations and your national recognition. And you certainly got on our radar screen, and we'll keep you there.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Okay, we were going to go now to an update on the CLASS project with Sue Hildick and some of her crew from Chalkboard. We were about this last time. Sure.
Oh. Yeah. Sit, girl, boy.
Okay.
Red, gray.
There we go.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sue Hildick. I'm the president of Chalkboard. I'm going to let my fellow panel introduce themselves.
I'm Terrell Smith, teacher and Sherwood Union president as well.
Kate Dixon, vice president, Chalkboard for Education Policy.
Dan Jamison, superintendent for Sherwood School District.
Thank you for having us here today. We're excited to be here to give you an update on where we are. I think you know Chalkboard's work is about raising student achievement in Oregon in K-12 schools. We're now in our fifth year. I say that with sort of a gasp. It's flown by, and we've worked on a variety of issues, but we've recently really focused in on the issue of raising teacher effectiveness, and decided that we're going to spend our next 5 years very much focused on that issue and trying to support efforts that do that work. We know the quality of the teacher in the classroom is the most influential factor on raising student achievement, and we want Oregon to recruit and retain the very best and brightest in this important field. We're concerned about the facts, and you know what they are. Nearly 40% of our new teachers are leaving the profession in 5 years. And annual turnover costs are about $45 million. So those are two issues that really have been troublesome to us. Our primary investment in this area is the Class Project. I think you've heard about it before. We're now in our second year of implementation in the first three districts. You'll hear from Sherwood today. The others are Tillamook and Forest Grove. And we've recently expanded the Class Project to 9 additional districts. That's all of Central Oregon, Lebanon, Oregon City, and Vernonia. And with that, we have now 1 in every 6 Oregon children now in a class district. Class is about educators having a new conversation about career opportunities. And I'm pleased to tell you that we now have a waiting list of districts who want to come into the project. A key point for you to remember is we really require that when districts come into class, they have the support of their union leadership, their administration, and their school board all together up front. That's an agreement that we really want to see before we begin. And the end result is a locally developed, teacher-driven, uniquely Oregon career model. We are pleased that class fits very nicely into the new federal program of Race for the Top. And Dan Jamison, who you'll hear from Sherwood, has been chairing the teacher effectiveness group of the Race for the Top working group. And I think he'll share with you that most of the class components are included now in what will be Oregon's application for federal funds. Chalkboard will also be applying for federal funds in a couple of extra buckets outside of Race for the Top because we think that this program really fits nicely with the leadership that Secretary Duncan's providing. A couple just last points. We recently asked Oregonians about the class project or class-like initiatives, and over 77% of those we surveyed statewide said they would support a statewide program that includes rewarding teachers for new roles and responsibilities, staying current on methods, and results in student achievement. We're very pleased to have Sherwood as our partners and eager to give you their update today. I want to turn now to Kate Dixon, who's really been leading the class project, to go further.
Thank you, Sue, Senator Haas, and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today, and I'm going to very quickly just take you through some of the key components of the class project as a grounding. Most of you know and have heard from other reports that much of this work is based on the research that shows just unequivocally that the greatest difference in student achievement is made by the classroom teacher. There's lots of other factors that come into play in relationship to student learning, but no factor more significant than the role of the teacher. And some of us that have been around a long time will go, duh, you know, we sort of already know that. But at the same time, it really is important that we recognize that significant role, that you can implement lots of different program initiatives, but unless you have a great teacher in that classroom delivering instruction for children, it does not make the kind of difference that we would all like for our own children and for the children in Oregon classrooms. So it's that research that we base the class project on, is that if we were going to make a difference in the quality of teaching and learning in our Oregon classrooms, it is about supporting the teachers in doing their very best work. And as we began to peel back the layers of that onion and that says what supports teachers in their role and for them to be able able to do their very best work. We found four very compelling integrated components, and they've ended up being the four what we call puzzle pieces to the class project. And one of those puzzle pieces, and one of the most significant ones, is expanded career opportunities for teachers. We hear over and over again from Oregon teachers and nationally, if you ask teachers what's important to them in their career, they want the opportunity to be leaders, and they want to advance in their career, and they do not want to become administrators. Now, I became an administrator, and I was very happy about that, but not all teachers want to do that, and we need teacher leaders in our schools. They do make a significant difference, and this project is aimed at accelerating career opportunities for all teachers. The second component is professional development, and from the previous speaker and presenter, you heard from him the power of professional development in changing the ways children learn and schools are successful. We know through the research that ongoing research-based relevant professional development makes a difference for the instructional program in the classroom for children. And so we want to support teachers with a much more relevant job-embedded opportunity for professional learning and ongoing learning. And then thirdly is that whole process of performance evaluation. How do we know the teacher's doing their best work? And so in this project, the districts have made a significant investment and in training and in resources to increase the quality and the effectiveness of the evaluation process for all teachers. And it includes a much more formative process where teachers talk about their practice in professional learning teams, and it's a much more relevant way of creating a performance evaluation. And then the fourth component that tends to make everyone jittery, and my friend Terrell Smith here from the union will talk about how that's working in Sherwood, but it is about new compensation models for teachers, and it's also not about merit pay schemes. Those new compensation models accelerate the compensation for new teachers and for teachers that are putting together evidence of effective professional practice. And one of the things that we found in our research, and one of the reasons we really focused on accelerating the pay of particularly new teachers, is that one of the reasons why new teachers leave is that based on the comparisons with other salary studies, the compensation for new teachers tends to be lower and not comparable. And we think that there are ways that we can increase the quality of teaching and learning and also support our new teachers in their career path and their compensation model. So those are the four pieces. And I think what's unique about this project, and one of the things that I really want people to carry away with them, is that this is not one or the other. This isn't performance evaluation and not professional development. This isn't about advancing careers and not new compensation models. We're really looking at an integrated process that really advances the career models and opportunities for teachers with new compensation models. And so we're pretty excited about that. And so then the so what question would be is how does this work? And we do have three districts right now that are just starting their second year of implementation, Sherwood being one of those. Tillamook is another school district that's having great success, as well as Forest Grove School District. We've invited Sherwood here today because we wanted to give you an example of the kind of work that's happening on the ground. And as we conclude our remarks, we also want to bring into evidence sort of the so what question. And the so what question is, what difference does this make for student achievement? And Sherwood has some very encouraging early indicators of success in relationship to that as well. So with that, I'd like to turn this over to Terrell Smith, who is a teacher and a very fine teacher, as well as the union president in Sherwood. Terrell?
Chairman Hess and committee members, appreciate the chance to chat with you a little bit about this. I have a speech here, and I could do this, and then it may not be exactly what you want to know. And so as teachers, you know, we kind of do the need-to-know, teach to the need-to-know basis. So I guess I'm going to compromise a little bit, give my speech, but I would entertain questions, hard questions, and the harder the better, actually, because that's how we learn. and how we move forward. My daughter's name is Jenica, and she's a third-year teacher in Sherwood. And as we embarked on this 2.5 years ago, she was a first-year teacher, and I looked at the career of teaching from my 31 years. And actually, we represented the bookends of the teaching longevity in Sherwood and probably in Oregon teaching. And I looked at that and said, you know, and Kate indicated, what are the career paths? What are the traditional career paths for teachers? And it was through administration and through administration. And really, you know, where do we go as teachers if we want to look to take on leadership roles? And what we've done through this this program is to provide other opportunities for young teachers and career teachers as well. So I looked at this and said, can we embrace this project to do two things? Teachers are in the business to raise student achievement. That's why we came. You know, we came to change the world through our students. We came to change the students' world. Both we can do. And in a process, we want a rewarding career. And so the chalkboard project gave us the external funds to be able to knock on the door of innovation and to see if we could find something that actually did both and created an increase in student achievement as well as an enhanced teaching career. And so we embarked on that, and 2.5 years ago, we had 11 teachers, three classified staff, and three administrators that took on this daunting task, maybe the first in Oregon for some time, to look at innovations and the ways that we could improve our evaluation process, our professional development, and our compensation model. Out of that, we thought we could create those expanded career opportunities. Maybe to be mentor teachers, take on roles as TOSAs and some other things that we can create. We need to have within our district to kind of reward teachers for their professionalism. And through this, we kept the whole idea that we needed to do both, improve student achievement and teacher career opportunities and enhancement. So one of the things that really helped our group was to involve nearly the entire staff of Sherwood School District, including the classified. The administrators were certainly there because this had a high interest for them, but the two employee groups involved were the teachers and the classified, and really it takes a village to educate a child. And in our case, we included the entire educational village. And we will see through multiple measures, student achievement increase. And that is a result of a big team, the entire team getting after the idea that we're all there to increase student achievement. One of the significant things that we were involved in was developing a very positive supportive evaluation process. Now, I don't know if that sounds kind of odd for a teacher to say a supportive evaluation process. It's not, and we wanted one that would be formative, that would inform my practice. For example, if my superintendent, Dan, came by and visited my class, you know, and he went through this evaluation process that we've created, teacher and administrative collaboratively created, I want him to be able to help me become a better teacher in that evaluation process. We think we've created a model through the Danielson's silos and group, back, you know, the concepts that Danielson has put forth to be able to create something that really helps improve the teaching practice in our district. Side story, I said my daughter was a third-year teacher. This business is hard, and these young teachers are challenged to be able, and part of the reason that I think we have attrition is that this is a difficult business. And my daughter was no different. Between second and third year, we had conversations about how difficult this business was. And I really truly believe that because of the support that we have in place through this class project for Sherwood teachers, mentoring, an evaluation process that's formative and objective, staff development that reaches the really important needs of our teachers, that and my daughter's going to stay in the business and she's excited about teaching this year. And we had some questions about that, as all young teachers do as they go through. So, you know, I really feel like, you know, I have a personal story to tell regarding what class has done for our young staff in Sherwood. The one thing that we have done with the staff development is we have created the professional learning communities, or in our case, we call them collaborative learning teams, CLTs. And those are teacher-directed initiatives. And that puts the power back to the teacher. Example, well, I have seen personally significant improvements in our behavioral culture at Sherwood High School because of a teacher-initiated PBS program, Positive Behavior Support. We have seen our failure rate for our freshmen go way down because a group of teachers said, you know what, this is not acceptable, and created strategies for improving that process. Another situation was at our middle school, we discovered that there was a trend in a downturn in our seventh grade writing achievement. So a group of teachers got together and decided, you know what, we want to look at the data and find out why, create strategies to improve that process, and they did. And we have seen student achievement increase in our writing, our middle school writing. So we have plenty of examples of how the class project has improved teaching and learning in Sherwood, and I want to just emphasize the fact that it's the improvement of student achievement and improvement of the satisfaction in the teaching core. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Jameson, my boss.
One of those teachers who did go on to become an administrator.
That is true many years ago, Mr. Chairman. So, well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I would like to share with you a little bit about the results that we've seen after 1 year. I will begin by saying that school reform and guaranteeing sustainable change and improvement in schools is complex work. And normally, when we have major reform initiatives, you'll see 2, 3, 4 years before you start seeing sustained results. You have in front of you a document. The document is called the Class Scorecard. It's a one-page quick read. One of the things that I would emphasize about the class project, I believe that Wisely Chalkboard has contracted with Portland State University to do an independent audit of results. So what you see here comes from a neutral third party. The first thing that I would highlight for you in the way of results is that we improved in 17 out of 20 Oregon State assessments. That's the best year I've seen in Sherwood since I've been here, and that spans a total of 5 years. We're very, very pleased not only with the standard assessments, but as Terrell mentioned, some of those smaller group-focused, teacher-designed results that we know have a big, big impact on kids. Terrell talked a little bit about the freshman failure rate. I know all of you feel as passionately as I do and as other leaders around the state feel about hanging on to our kids and guaranteeing that we do not have dropouts. To be able to reduce the freshman failure rate by half in the first year and simultaneously increase the achievement of the same kids in standardized tests is a fairly remarkable accomplishment. On the back of your page, as you look at a bar graph, that is reflective of professional attitudes about professional development and growth. This is really based upon the work of a researcher by the name of Shirley Horde, and as you see the bar graphs on the top compared to the ones on the bottom underneath, you'll see that in almost every category, we doubled the effectiveness based upon teacher feedback of the meaningfulness of the professional development and their stake in having a choice about what they could do and what would make a difference for kids. I'd also like to talk a little bit about high schools. I think we all have a great sense of focus and urgency about the performance of our high schools in the state. We're in the midst of a shift with the Oregon State Report Card. It's based upon a growth model, which we welcome. I do believe that that will be tweaked and adjusted in the future, as it should be. But I will just speak from experience from Sherwood High School, which is a school with about 1,300 students. Last year, we increased our reading scores by about 3 to 4%, math scores about 5%, science scores by about 6%. We maintained our writing scores at 84%, which is in the top 10 in the state of Oregon. It's very unusual to get that strong, steady growth, not only at the high school level, but also across an entire K-12 organization. We believe that we're onto something very, very important, and we believe that the results that we're seeing initially are very, very powerful. The thing that I would end with is what really we began with when Sue started sharing with you, and that is this collective resolve throughout the organization. You will hear this from my school board members. You will hear it from parents in our community. You'll hear it from our union president and certainly our partners at Chalkboard. The quality of the professional educator is the greatest single driver to student achievement. This project is about investing in our professionals, doing so in a sustained manner, so that we can guarantee our kids throughout Oregon are getting the best. And that's why I believe it holds such great promise for us. Thank you. And I think we all would be ready to entertain questions at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. This was very interesting. I'd like to get a little bit more detail, and I don't care who answers. You can all chime in about actually how it's working in terms of the levels, because your brochure says new roles for teachers as leaders and mentors, and then Mr. Smith talked about the collaborative learning teams, and I just actually finished a really interesting book I picked up called Who's Teaching Your Children? I don't know if you've read it, but it's from a couple of people, and academics in the East Coast, and they suggested something very similar. They called it either a millennial school or millennium school, and they had several different levels of teachers, from interns to associate teachers to teachers to, and then they had the higher level teachers supervising groups of other teachers. And so I thought that was a fascinating concept, which sounds similar to what you're doing. So I'd really like to know, do you have, because I can see how it's important to have opportunities for teachers to advance without leaving the classroom. So I want to know a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of how it works in the schools. Is it just, are there just the two levels, teacher and mentor, or are there more opportunities?
Okay, that's a question with a long answer, but I'll try to be brief.
It's a long question. So.
Yeah, no, that actually was a long question. And my answer would probably be a little bit longer than that. But we have three levels, and we didn't want to name them. We didn't want to label teachers. We have level one, two, and three, and level one will be our beginning teachers, teachers that are in the career for their first time. And so we want to provide a lot of support for them, because we know that if we identify some really up-and-coming teachers with a lot of potential, and in our building, in our district, we can provide the mentoring, the staff development, and the clear evaluation process to help those teachers become stars. If they choose to stay in the business, and we believe they will, then they will move after 3 years from the traditional probation period into what we call level two. And at that point in time, what we decided, and we kind of reverse engineered this, you hear a lot about testing, paying for test scores, test students often, and kind of get a picture of what your education system is like, and that's okay for the broad picture. But what we wanted to do is take the focus away from testing, at least on the career side, and focus on the teacher quality model. And we've created an idea that what a teacher does inside and outside the classroom will result in increased student achievement. And we're going to do that through a portfolio basis, and that is a student or a teacher has an opportunity to gather professional practice evidence, and they meet a threshold of what we consider, they've been around, they've done enough, they've been in the business, they do some action research of a growth achievement in their own students. They coach the robotics club after school. They are on a chair of the psych committee, and we have a whole list of things. But when they reach a threshold, they'll move to level three. And in the process of moving from level one to two, they will advance on a salary schedule. They'll skip a longevity step, and when they advance from career two to career three, they will skip two longevity steps, which essentially addresses what Kate indicated earlier. We needed a comparison. We need to accelerate the salary in a way that relates to teacher quality and teacher, professional practice. So in our case, just down to the salary schedule, it takes 16 years to get to the top. And if a teacher chooses to participate in this model, they can get there in 13 years. So it accelerates their earnings while rewarding them for their professional practice. So that's kind of bringing the compensation into it. And then I forgot that other half of your question, but regarding the staff development, I believe?
No, the range of, okay. of of teacher, are there different levels of teachers? And it looks like there are the three.
There are the three. I'd like to also, if I may, Senator, talk about another form of leadership and choice for our professionals that I think is characteristic of this project. Terrell would not tell you this, but recently he was chosen Oregon's Technology Teacher of the Year, and he's a leader around the state. We know that there's a growing conversation, not only in Oregon, but nationally, about the importance of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And in our district, we've created positions, technology coaches, for our professionals to advance the work of technology with a specific emphasis on instructional impact. These technology coaches have worked together with a stipend from this project, and they have designed professional proficiency, basic, proficient, and then master teacher levels with a goal for all professionals in our organization over the course of 4 to 5 years to elevate their degree of proficiency with cutting-edge technology. Now, part of that is because we want to be better in the classroom, but the other part of that is a simple recognition. This is the currency of information that our students work with. This would not be happening otherwise without teacher leadership. By the way, as a superintendent, this is the type of change that's almost impossible to drive from the top down when it's fed from the bottom up, when it's initiated by teachers, when it's a great purpose and aligned with student achievement as the outcome, great things will unfold. And that's the kind of excitement we're seeing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, I just want to reiterate that the teacher levels are going to look different in each district. Each district is going to design what works for them. And I think in Tillamook we're working with 4 levels, so a key component of this is it's really tailored to the district needs. In Tillamook, the needs are retention. You know, they find that they can't keep a teacher 5 years, they're basically sending people to Dan. And so
they are tired of doing that.
So their model looks quite different, and it's really about getting teachers to that fifth year with a lot of support and then keeping them.
And then a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. Do I assume correctly that this is all done without additional funding? Or other than what I understand the chalkboard has funding, but do the districts get additional funding?
The districts are matching our grants. These are sizable grants, and the districts have been matching them, in most cases more than matching them, with Title II federal dollars and other state dollars. Now, Dan is sort of cutting edge in developing the long-term financial model that makes this sustainable when our dollars go away. You want to say a few words about that?
I will speak to that, and that's a great question. We just actually presented to the Oregon School Boards Association last Friday on our 10-year financial model. The investment in each professional is greater at the front end of their career, to the tune of about $53,000 spread out over the course of a 30-year career. Okay, so the accelerated pay allows us to hang on to professionals early in their careers, not lose them, invest in the professional development, accelerate them through the pay scale. We believe that this additional cost over the course of our model over 10 years results in an additional cost of a maximum of about $600,000 in any given year. Now, the way that I translate that, and this is a policy level decision for school board and certainly for district leaders like myself, what is that cost in terms of additional class size if we were forced to make a value choice? And that difference is the equivalent of 0.8 or less than one student per classroom in an entire K-12 system. So there's a value choice that comes with this with the additional cost, and that is, would I trade a slightly larger class size, maybe up to one student per classroom, in exchange for having the most highly motivated, the most engaged, the most highly retained, and the most professionally prepared, competent workforce in public education? And the answer is yes.
On the subject of money, I hate to talk about the tawdry subject of money, but can you tell us how much you received, what the grant was, what the match was, how many schools and teachers participated, and how the money was doled out, if you will?
Yes, and if I forget something, feel free to follow up. We worked with the school districts initially by giving them a $30,000 design grant, which was lasted about over a 9-month period of time, and that was for release time and bringing teachers together and others together to design the components of this class project. And as a result of that planning and design, they presented chalkboard with a proposal detailing out their design for these four components. And we began the first year of implementation, and the cost of that first year implementation from chalkboard side of the fence was about $400,000, which is equivalent, just closely equivalent to $100 per student. And as Sue said, the districts did match that with other investments and continuing investments that they were already making. So the grant from Chalkboard is based on a 3-year implementation grant of about $400,000 per year to provide the incentive resources and to move this forward.
How many teachers?
Thank you for that. In Sherwood, Forest Grove, and Tillamook, each district is including all of their schools and all of their teachers. So, and I know the rough numbers. You probably know the exact number, Dan. For Sherwood, that's about 260 teachers. In Forest Grove, that's about 350 teachers. And in Tillamook, it's about 125 to 200 teachers. I can't quite remember the number, but it ultimately, in our case, with all three districts combined, comes pretty close to about 800 to 900 teachers.
What does a teacher have to do to receive an incentive?
Go ahead.
Well, one of the guidelines that we had set out early is that we wanted this to be a choice. We wanted the teachers to see this as an opportunity, and that they could, you know, reach their teaching passions through this model and then be rewarded. So it is a choice. You know, a teacher can choose to participate in this. Now, except for the beginning teachers, we're going to tell them that they're going to get mentored and they're going to have to do significant staff development and, you know, and so forth and so on, because they're new to this business and we think we can help them get a lot better. Anyway, so they really don't have a choice. That's our culture in Sherwood. It was created by the class project.
But I'm just wondering, is this now based on student achievement, test scores? What kinds of things are you rewarded for if you were a teacher?
We kind of drew the line, not kind of, we did draw the line between standardized test scores and teacher salaries and career progression. And there are many reasons why we chose to do that, and I guess one of them would be that I would not have had the support of my staff if they were worried about how their students achieved on a test and that their salary and career would be based on that. We like the idea of multiple measures and or growth measures for student achievement as we evaluate our building and district's success in the business. But as it relates to teachers' salary and career growth, we wanted to focus on what the teacher did, their professional practice, their professional growth. And if they chose to use student achievement as an evidence, then they do action research with their own students, pretest, post-test, document practices that improve their student achievement. And so we wanted to put it back in the hands of the teacher. And if they chose to participate in this program, then they had a lot of opportunities. So maybe your next question would be, how many of the teachers do I anticipate will do this? And 100% of the young teachers will, because that's our culture. The teachers that are beyond probation then have a choice to participate, to gather points, to build a portfolio, or they can continue to teach, as I have done over 31 years, kind of a straight line teaching career. I anticipate that 80% of our teachers will actively be involved in the point gathering system. Maybe I'm a little optimistic there, but just think of it. If we have 60-70% of our teachers that have stepped up to this level of professional evidence gathering and get involved in maybe not so many things, but deeper in their passions in their district, the problem Dan's going to have is he may not have enough committees for my people. And you just think about things that when, you know, 60-70% of your teaching staff see the opportunity and that they will be rewarded for their professional practice. And it's not tied to student test scores, but tied to them, the teacher going to a conference, coaching a robotics club after school, as I indicated earlier, being on the site council or chairing that, which is really, really important. So, you know, we think we will change the culture of teaching and learning in Sherwood through this process.
Just one other comment relative to Terrell sharing about professional practice. I also want to emphasize something that he shared earlier, and that is about the rigor and the focus of our professional evaluation process now. Driven by teachers and a conversation that was initiated by our professional staff, we've adopted this very rigorous professional evaluation model based upon the Danielson framework, where we are holding our administrators accountable in great detail as we have a professional observer come in and observe them as they are engaged in the evaluation process, not only because we want our administrators to be better, but our teaching staff is demanding that. So as we talk about professional practice, I want you to know this is not a soft, feel-good approach. It's a very rigorous, research-based approach to professional performance.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
A couple questions, Mr. Chair. This is fascinating. Are you utilizing students in your evaluation process? Mm-hmm. In other words, I mean, the two people that are most engaged in the educational moment are the teachers and the students. And one of the things that's always bothered me about assessment is, you know, you're picking points in time sort of thing. And you can do it with extra this or extra that. I understand that. But one thing that I've always thought would be helpful would be to get the student's opinion because they do have opinions. And, you know, as I know that virtually any teacher that's had any tenure at all can go after a short period of time in the class, can tell you who the problem children are and who the exceptional ones are and all that. And the students can do the same thing with teachers, and some are better than others. So is that being considered at all in this?
The answer at the current time is formally no.
Okay.
Informally, there is that practice going on. Terrell, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm a track and field coach, and so in order for me to get better, it's nice to do an evaluation at the end of the year. All right, kids, you know, what about your coaching staff? How can we get better? And that can work as well. So built into the professional practice can easily be what we created, the action research, which is a bucket of look at your class, teachers, gather some evidence for your practice. And that can be evidence of your professional practice, which could advance you. So that might be that I do a pretest, teach, look at strategies that are effective, ask the students to fill out a survey at the end of the year on what they thought of that learning process or me as a teacher. And I think it's, as we, you know, we don't require it, but it's a great idea. You know, it gives us feedback on our practice, and you know, it's a little, I will admit that it makes me nervous to lay out a survey that says, all right, T. Smith, tell me, T. Smith, you are a, and then a scale of 5, you know, great to the worst teacher I've ever had. You become vulnerable, but it's really important, and I think it's a good practice, and it is, can be, and is part of our model.
I would almost personally think you'd wait till the next year and then ask them once the connection was severed. And so, well, you know, sometimes some space gets more objectivity sort of thing. I'm really interested in doing evaluations that aren't just test driven, because I have serious issues with that. One other question, Mr. Chair. You're bringing people into this. How do you deal with those who don't measure up?
I'll be happy to speak to that. It becomes, in our system, it becomes very, very evident, very, very fast, those folks who are not in the right profession. And I will speak to that even more concretely. I think there is perhaps in the state a bias or maybe a stereotype of conflict between district administrators and association representatives where there's intentional blocking or protecting of folks who are not performing. I have not found that to be the case. And what I would also suggest is by a teacher-driven and great investment in a professional evaluation instrument that is research-based, not only does that hold teaching staff more accountable, it holds me more accountable. So are there folks who are removed from our system? Yes. Those cases are not coming along with great, great infrequency. There are folks who have to exit the system, and I think we find that we come to resolution on those very rapidly and fairly and within the confines of contract.
I'll just say from the union president that I sit in on those meetings, and our contract and most all contracts in Oregon give clear guidelines on how that process should happen, and it does happen and can happen.
Okay, and it's important. There are good and bad in every profession, and we know that. And there's protection and non-protection in every, you know, I understand all that. I just, I go way back, I think it was 97. There was a hot issue at that point in time. It was, may have been Neil Bryant's bill, actually, on it had to do with tenure.
Yes.
And I was in a meeting in Roseburg, where I'm from, and it was at the ESD, and there were 150 teachers in the room because they seemed to be somewhat upset with the concept. And I asked the question, I said, because I had teachers from every school basically in the county, I said, do any of you have teachers in your building that don't measure up?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody raised their hand. And I guarantee you there's probably one in Douglas County. So, that's just the reality. So, what I'm hearing here is good because you're not necessarily the bad guy.
Right.
And it's a collaborative effort to encourage folks that this isn't where they should be to go find where their actual bliss is. So.
And Senator Cruz, if I may, one small add-on that's very important. That standard is true of leaders as well,
mm-hmm.
educational
mm-hmm.
leaders.
Yes.
I hold our principals, and I hold my cabinet to that same very high standard, and we need to be just as rigorous with our educational leaders as we are with our association members.
Mr. Chair, I would agree. As important as the teacher is to the educational process, if the principal of that school isn't up to snuff, nothing's going to work for the most part because it's a disorganized business. So,
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify one thing? When I mentioned our new 9 districts, I think I left out Salem. And I want you to know we're working there because, you know, that's 40,000 children. That is a much more complex environment than we've been in before, and we're pretty encouraged so far. But that may be a situation where we can't fund every school. It may be that we take a subset of schools within that district to actually, you know, implement.
Okay. Well, we thank you for Chalkboard's contribution to Oregon schools. You've got 9 districts so far. You've got
9 new, 3 existing, so 12.
12. So you've got about 180 to go.
We may need your help with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
14.
Okay, the theme of the day has been innovation and streamlining, and in keeping with that theme, we have a report on the streamlining operations in higher ed and the implementation of Senate Bill 442 with the Chancellor, George Furstiner, Dr. Larry Galizio, and Cam Price from the community colleges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm with the Oregon University System, and I am joined today by Cam Preuss, who is the Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and Dr. Larry Galizio, the Planning Director for the Oregon University System. And first, I want to thank you for not just this opportunity, but also for the enactment of Senate Bill 442, because as you're going to hear pretty soon, the conversations that has engendered among the universities and the community colleges and increasingly with some of the K-12 schools, I think will have a big impact long-term on educational attainment in Oregon. And I think that's really what we're all about, and I'm very pleased to report that that's underway. Senate Bill 442 had several dimensions to it. I'm going to touch briefly on some of them and then turn it to Larry and Cam to actually provide more detail on some. The first was that you asked us to take a look between the universities and the community colleges about the possible implementation of a semester term system. Dr. Galizio will speak about that, both with respect to what they have found thus far and with respect to the committee that they are putting together in order to pursue this more vigorously and more diligently. I would note, too, that some of the universities and some of the community college have in fact expressed interest in participating in this, and I know that during the session I was a little skeptical that I could find volunteers. We have found volunteers. They weren't who I expected them to be, but we have found volunteers, which I think is an interesting thing. The second dimension deals with the educational access and attainment in the rural parts of the state, and to me that's a very exciting undertaking that Dr. Galizio will Commissioner Preuss will report about. But for me, it's perhaps the most rewarding part of this work because it has engendered conversations in Eastern Oregon and in other parts of the state that I was hoping would start, and they have started. So I thank you for that. That really, the convening role which the Senate bill allowed has really proven to be important, and I think I want to give you credit for that because oftentimes we don't do that, and so I thought it would do. You asked us also to look at the consolidation of enrollment management offices at the four smaller universities. This is along the model that Southern Oregon University had already implemented. Eastern Oregon University, at the moment that we speak, is in the process of implementing a similar consolidation of enrollment management functions so that will be in place prior to the start of the next academic year. For both OIT and Western, they are continuing to consider it, and we will be having conversations with them about what they would recommend to happen going forward. But at least at the moment, we have one other university following the lead that Southern set prior to the start of the last session. Another dimension of this bill talked about the State Board of Higher Education examining the missions of each of the institutions and then taking a look at duplicative programs and other aspects. The board at its retreat, which will begin on December the 1st, will in fact begin that conversation with the campuses. They will delegate some of that work to the Provost Council, but that actually is something that will begin in about 2 weeks and will fit nicely within the board's calendar. I would note, though, that you also talked in there about collaborative efforts to serve various parts of the state. And although much of that will be discussed as the Rural Access Committee does its work, I'm happy to report that we have some new undertakings now that I think will have some impact in the long term. And they can come through a partnership between Oregon State University's Extension Service and their Extension faculty and a couple of the community colleges, Tillamook Bay Community College and Central Oregon Community College, with regard to programs that OSU's Extension faculty can offer in collaboration with those community colleges. That is something that we had not really talked about in the last session because the Extension folks had not really begun to roll that out, but they have done it already, and I wanted to give them some credit for that in this forum. You also talked in this bill about a common admissions process within the university system to allow students who would apply to one institution to be considered for admission to another. The board, as you know, the Board of Higher Education last spring adopted the policy framework to allow that to occur. At the start of this biennial period, my office funded an undertaking at Oregon State University, which does all of our computer programming for us. All the system-wide programs are run by Oregon State. They have designed, programmed, and tested a system that would allow the software to allow the sharing. That system will be rolled out first at Western Oregon University starting over Thanksgiving weekend. So we will be ready
by the time the big influx of student applications comes for the fall of 2010, assuming that all the tests go well over Thanksgiving weekend at Western, and I have every reason to believe that they will. But as we noted, University of Oregon and Southern Oregon University last spring decided that they would do a bilateral agreement, and in fact, a number of students participated in that were jointly admitted to the University of Oregon, Southern Oregon University. About 15 of them actually are enrolled at SOU this fall as U of O students in attendance at SOU. And so we're monitoring that carefully as their progress goes forward. As you know, they have the choice at the end of their sophomore year to either finish their degree at the Eugene campus or at the Ashland campus. And, of course, we don't know what they will choose. But it's important to note that because these kinds of undertakings often have a long gestation period, and yet in many of these things we've already begun work and in that particular case already have students involved. And I think that it's important to note that. So, again, I thank you very much for the impetus that Senate Bill 442 gave us, and I'm going to turn it over to the folks who know a lot more than I do to continue the discussion with regard to both semesters and rural. And I think Dr. Galizio will start that.
Thank you very much. For the record, Larry Galizio, Oregon University System. And some certainly were skeptical of Senate Bill 442. And I think when I was on the other side of the dais, I was, but I would concur with the Chancellor, just doing work, especially vis-a-vis rural students. I think that's a very exciting element to this. But what I thought I would do is talk a little bit about the semester conversion, and then Commissioner Preuss is also going to talk about semester conversion, and then I think we're going to switch over to get more in detail about the rural student success and participation. So the first thing that I did was get a huge box that had the history from the Oregon University System of the aborted attempt to convert the universities and community colleges to the semester system in the late 1980s. And I think you do have a chronology before you. And if you have not had a chance to read that, I would suggest that you do so at some point. It's quite interesting. Maybe some of you were around during that. You don't have that. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think so.
You don't have a chronology? Okay, well, I could tell you, and we'll make sure to get those to you. Wasn't in there? All right. Well, I can give you the...
I have the arguments for...
And you don't have the chronology? Okay, well, we'll get that to you, but I'll give you the upshot for those of you who don't remember. It was decided by the board, the higher ed board, that in 1987 that there was going to be a switch to semester, the conversion to the semester, all the university system was going to go to the semester calendar. And unfortunately, there was a lack of discussion with the community colleges, who were subsequently sort of surprised. So that was a problem that I don't think you would see again, and I think Commissioner Preuss would agree with that. But in a sense, all of the provosts, administrators, faculty members did what some estimated to be about 150,000 hours of work for the semester conversion. It's quite an undertaking. And then there were concerns by the food processing and some in the agricultural industry and even in the tourism industry that were concerned that the academic calendar change would mean you would not have those students working in those fields. And I don't, no pun intended. And so what happened was at the sort of 11th hour, after a great deal of work had been done, almost 80% of the conversion, you know, the work for the conversion had been done, from pressure, quite frankly, from this body at the time, the board reversed its decision. And so even today, when I first started talking to people in our university system about it, those who'd been here in the late 80s and experienced that, where they'd done a great deal of work, and then it was kind of pulled out, the rug was pulled out from under them, there is a hangover that still exists. Having said that, there are many people who are no longer here who were present during that time. But that's something I just thought it was important for you to know, and like I said, we'll get you the chronology there. So, looked at other states in the last two decades and what their experiences have been vis-a-vis semester conversion. And you should have a document there, I hope, which discusses the experiences from some of the other states. You do have that one. It's got a bunch of websites on it on the first page. Okay. I'm not going to go over this entire document, but I would recommend you looking at that, not just the websites, but you will see we looked at some other states, Utah, Cincinnati. Ohio is now going through semester conversion for all its institutions. It's quite instructive. What I found overwhelmingly in terms of common themes, number one is none of the institutions with whom I spoke in those different states, and of course they're all configured differently, said that they have achieved significant savings in terms of money. Even though they have maybe, you know, two registration periods and two financial disbursement periods. Having said that, since every state is uniquely different, part of the reason we're constituting the group here in Oregon is because Oregon is unique and has a unique set of circumstances, and so we're going to drill down in Oregon and take a look, you know, what would be the costs and what would be the necessary investment. But that was one thing that I know you, Chair Haas, and members of the committee were very interested in. So I think the jury is out on whether or not you can achieve financial savings in the semester system. Again, it's something we're looking at more. Secondly, and I know the major reason that you were looking at semester conversion was pedagogy. In other words, better teaching and learning taking place. And I was surprised at the lack of empirical research studying this specifically. And talking to other states, they as well said that really it's difficult to find specific data on whether or not that lengthier semester is better. You hear arguments for both sides, but sort of a paucity of research on whether or not the semester is indeed. You have certainly a lot of preferences from different professors, faculty members, and administrators. But that's something that if there's a graduate student listening to this and they want to do a dissertation, I think that would be a great topic. But again, need to look at that, and you do have different preferences. I'm going to turn it over to Cam. The last thing that, the most recent thing that we did, there was a presentation of a lot of the documentation that you have before you in terms of the arguments for and against semesters or quarters presented to the Provost Council and the chief academic officers at our Oregon community colleges. And we had an interesting discussion about the calendars and the arguments and the research, but I think what was most interesting was the perspective of many of the community college chief academic officers who were certainly concerned about the impact it might have on the career technical education programs, as well as the desire to maybe broaden the discussion that looking at seat time and just an academic calendar, they questioned the validity of that or whether or not that's where we wanted to go. So I think I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Preuss on that topic because I think it's quite relevant.
Good afternoon. For the record, I am Cam Preuss. I am the Commissioner of Community Colleges and the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And I think Larry has captured, I think quite eloquently, the conversation that is happening with academic leaders in the community colleges. And their thinking has converged around this as an opportunity to address more flexibility and access for students, more concentration on learning outcomes and achievement of proficiency, and perhaps less about term length as an either-or decision, because as students enter, and the chancellor and I are both dealing with a surge in enrollment, the likes of which we have neither of our systems have ever seen, and open entry, open exit courses are more a matter of necessity these days than you have to wait until this start date, just simply because of capacity issues. So it's for us right now, and I think I can speak for the academic leaders, it is less about term length and that either-or decision and more about how to figure out the best hybrids that are going to exist, including both class time, distance learning, all of those things together in order to serve students better, which I think is a nice segue to the rural initiative, which is all about, I think, the second study in Senate Bill 442 calls for, quote, approaches to increase student enrollment and student success for rural residents. And we have formed a study group. It's made up of members of the State Board of Higher Education, State Board of Education, and three presidents from both systems. And they have begun their work, and they began it by soliciting feedback from community colleges and university leaders on what's working. What are you doing that's unique or different, both in around enrollment management or recruitment and retention strategies. We've also gathered some national research. There's quite a lot that's been done in community colleges that is focused on the role of the rural community college as a community gathering point and leader there. But it is all about increasing access and success for rural residents, and I'd ask Larry to talk a little more about what we've learned in that process.
Okay, thank you. So the first thing that it was suggested for me that I should do, because there are people who have been doing this thing quite a bit longer than myself, is to survey, to find out, you know, what's happening in the status quo at our institutions of higher education vis-a-vis rural students. So we sent out surveys to the enrollment managers for OUS and their community college equivalents, saying, what are you doing now to increase the participation and success of rural resident students or rural residents. And you should have another document, I hope, that lists a summary of, one is a matrix from the Oregon University system of all the different approaches from the universities that list what they're doing. Okay, great. And then you should also have from the community colleges a summary, about 3-page summary. So the good news is there is quite a bit taking place and a diversity of approaches based on not the missions of the institutions, but where they are and their student body makeup and what their strengths are. So there's quite a bit going on now, and what we might find is that scaling up some of those current approaches might be effective. But I think in our first meeting we found that there are other things that we think can be done that will be quite successful. I did want to stop here briefly just to tell a little bit of a story that was quite an eye-opener for me. On September 24th, I went out to LeGrand, to Eastern Oregon University. It was sort of right before the term was going to begin, and there was a gathering of students, and I started just talking to some students, you know, why did you decide to come to Eastern Oregon University? And there was one young man from Grants Pass who had a cowboy hat and a big belt buckle and kind of reminded me of Senator Farioli. And I said, why are you here? What are you studying? And he told me I was looking into agriculture and agricultural management. And I said, oh. And he volunteered to me and said, I had looked at Oregon State University, but I didn't want to live in such a big city like Corvallis. And that was really quite an eye-opener for me. I don't know that many would think that Corvallis is a large metropolis. But for him, it was very important to have a university, a post-secondary setting where it was more intimate, and he felt like he was going to get sort of a education in a rural area. And also a big question about this that sort of hovers over all of this is the question of the quote-unquote rural brain drain, where, of course, you do not want young people going to universities and then never coming back, and you have that so-called rural brain drain. So that's a real concern. But we've had one meeting and looked at all this research and what's happening now, and there's some exciting conversations going on. And I think one of the elements that we're really looking at is sort of breaking down the barriers among the education sectors, because you have to work middle school, high school, community colleges, and the university system. And President Jim Middleton of Central Oregon has some great ideas. We're looking at how we can perhaps restructure or look at doing things in a way that blends the sectors in a way that's more effective. So I guess the only other thing I would say is, looking at data nationally, a hybrid model is quite effective. Simply distance learning or online education does not get you where you want to go in terms of retention. But a hybrid model can be quite effective. So I'll stop there.
I think what you're hearing is that we are in the early stages of gathering the information that will allow us to make some recommendations. But I would like to kind of emphasize a couple things that I think bear some repeating. When we take a look at the semesters, although we have institutions who are interested in that, what it may be is that we're not looking just at the term length, but also at the flexibility of the scheduling, particularly with regard to career and technical education. The other thing that was notable in what the academic officers of the community colleges said is, can we focus instead of seat time on proficiency? Interestingly, the joint boards of education and higher education at their joint meeting in January will in fact be dealing with that issue, because Oregon is one of the three states that has probably done the most work in trying to think through what are the proficiencies, what are the accomplishments you need both at the end of general education and at the end of a baccalaureate. So it fits nicely with the kinds of thinking that is happening with the community college academic leaders, and I'm sure that discussion will be a fairly robust one. What it's saying to me is that as we look at semesters, what we're really looking at is scheduling. It isn't just semesters. It's what works for the students, not just what works for the institutions. That there may or may not be cost savings, but that what we're really after here is student success. And I think as we look at this, I would hope as we have further conversation over the course of the interim, we can have conversation not just about what the calendar would look like, but also about how we then provide opportunities for students that meet their needs. I'm very encouraged with the work of the rural committee. Dr. Galizio talked about the breaking down of the segmental barriers among K-12, the community colleges, and the universities. This is happening because the people in the high schools, the community colleges, and the universities recognize that that's essential for student success. One of the things that I have learned recently, because I asked one of my staff to go back and look at how well do students do, who are going to be the most successful students that we have in the university system, and it came back resoundingly. It's those students who in high school have earned college credits, because it essentially teaches them that they have the ability to succeed in college, and it brings them a confidence as well as credit hours that help move them through that really we can't duplicate in any other way. And that's also what we're beginning to hear from this rural committee, is that working with the high schools, working with the middle schools, is very, very important. I was able to participate last week in a discussion in Central Oregon that really pointed out to me that even within Central Oregon, you have two very different educational systems, one for the big city of Bend, and one really when you get 30 or 40 miles away that looks much more like the kinds of things that Dr. Galizio was talking about, and with the kinds of strategies that he's talking about are the very things that Central Oregon Community College and the OSU Extension Service are now beginning to employ with the high schools. This is really exciting to me, because this gives promise of finally breaking what is at least a 30-year stalemate in how we approach success for rural students. I'm quite excited about it, and I really thank you for giving us this opportunity to engage this issue more directly and collaboratively than we might have been able to do otherwise. So with that, I think we throw it open to questions, and thank you again.
Okay. Questions?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you. Chancellor, you and I had talked about the common application, and I noticed on your what you passed out that it's not a common application form. Each university maintains its own application form and process. And I wonder if anyone has taken a look at that and at the common application, because having just gone through the process with two children who are both in college, I know that it's increasingly popular to fill out the common application. And many colleges and universities have a supplemental essay or something, but it tends to increase the number of schools that students apply to. And I know you have a surge now, but there may be a time when you want to have that additional incentive.
And that is something that we certainly will look at. I want to have first conversation with the University of Oregon and Oregon State, because part of it is, as you recruit internationally and across state boundaries, what is it that you want to have? What kind of information do you need? What kind of format do you want? So that I admit I have not had that conversation yet. I told you I would, and I will, but I haven't yet done it.
Thank you. And then just the other comment that I wanted to make about, I agree, Senator Cruz made a comment a little earlier about not being a big fan of standardized tests, and I share that concern. But when the Beaverton School District, for example, started giving the ACT to all of its students, they had a similar sort of situation as when students can get college credit in high school. All of a sudden there were students who otherwise wouldn't have taken the test who said, oh, well, I did pretty well. Maybe I should apply. So that was just one factor that gave some of those students encouragement, I think, to pursue.
The test for a different purpose.
Right.
Okay.
No, but I think that's a very intriguing way to get there, is to get to the high schools and get them engaged. And It just, I guess it stands to reason that if you're in Burns and you've already got some college credit and you say, well, maybe this wasn't so hard after all, and one thing leads to another. I think that's really, really very thought-provoking.
Senator Metzger? We haven't talked about Metzger in a while, but we're on higher ed now.
Well, I was just kind of wondering, you know, I was going to ask our former colleague, does he enjoy being called Dr. Galizio more than being when he used to be honorable? And honorable Galizio. I mean, I was just kind of wondering how that is. You know, the doctor thing, that's kind of cool. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Nobody ever believes the honorable part anyway, so it's...
It's amazing what a few votes will do. Yeah. Anyway, I have nothing to add, Mr. Chair.
Well, I guess I appreciate the work that you're doing now, and we'll go forward on this. I suppose I can't have you up here, Mr. Chancellor, without also then, since you're here, asking you about the Dave Frohnmayer's proposal, his white paper. I know you commissioned him or you asked him for his help on this, and I guess could you comment on, now that that's out, how that maybe parrots with some of these mandates that the legislature's asking you to do, and where you see that going short-term and near-term?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would very much appreciate the opportunity to do that. Last summer, I asked President Frohnmayer, as he was leaving his position as president, to take on a task of looking at how we in Oregon can meet the education attainment goals that we have set for ourselves in an era of increasingly constrained resources. Because I don't anticipate a quick turnaround to this economy, and I know that the federal stimulus money is going away at the end of this biennium, and so I was very concerned about how we would maintain the momentum that we had already built up and that was sort of reinforced by record enrollments at both the universities and community colleges this past fall. And so I asked him to take a look at how would we sustain that trajectory in that environment, and he came back with two recommendations, basically. The first one was that long-term, there is no substitute for state investment in its educational future. So part of it is money, but recognizing also that in 2011 the likelihood of money was fairly low, that additional flexibility for the three large universities would permit them to continue to make the kind of progress that we need, both in terms of enrollment and in terms of degrees in student success. His recommendation actually is that the State Board of Higher Education determine when each of the institutions might meet certain financial and other criteria that would permit them to have the degree of autonomy and flexibility that he is talking about. And that autonomy and flexibility would deal with a variety of issues, but mostly would deal with direct authority over their daily operations. Daily operations will include salaries, benefits, tuition, and aid policies. And I specifically asked him not to consider the smaller campuses in this undertaking because I wanted him to focus on those larger entities that would generate the most of the degrees in the state. What we are going to do now is at the day I mentioned, the board retreat that's coming up on December 1st, we will deal with mission, as I mentioned before, and program. On December 2nd, we will begin conversation with the State Board about structural reform or change within the state system and how that would be approached. In addition to what President Frohnmayer has so ably prepared and what he is proposing, we also will be taking a look at how do we make financial aid, by which I do not mean loans, a real part of the equation so that Oregonians believe that they can and will be able to afford to go to college and to continue through college to their degrees. And I think until we have dealt with that effectively, that will be an outstanding question that will make it difficult to make much progress in any other venue. We also have to deal effectively with the future of the smaller campuses, particularly as it relates to the success of Oregonians in the rural parts of the state. In many cases, as Dr. Galizio just indicated, they serve a function because of their size and their location that the larger campuses would not be able to serve. So we know we have to deal with that. We have to deal, thirdly, with the statewide public services, the Extension Service, the Forest Research Lab, and the Ag Experiment Station, none of which are tuition-funded, and therefore, if we go to a model that is more dependent upon tuition for the funding of the institutions, we have to address how will we deal with those very important statewide service functions and research functions that have been the underpinning of much of our economy and many of our communities for the last 100 years. We also will have to deal with the question of the students who now come to us both jointly and sequentially from the community colleges. One of the things that has happened intentionally, we intended this in the last 5 years, is we have changed dramatically the way in which students attend college in Oregon. In 1999, which was the last time that we saw a major increase in enrollment, 70% of the new students who came to us that year came to us directly from high school. 30% came from the community colleges. This fall, 55% of a much larger number came to us from the high schools. 45% came from the community colleges. We have really changed the way in which Oregonians attend college. And I want to make sure that the gains that we have made in that arena are sustained in whatever proposal we bring forward. What I will be discussing with the board then on December the 2nd is the framework within which we will address not just the recommendations that President Frohnmayer has made, but also these other important issues. And my hope is that we can work with you, this committee even, during the interim, as we evolve the strategies so that when we get into the 2011 session, we will be able to have a proposal that will, in fact, allow us to sustain the kinds of gains we've made educationally and enrollment, regardless of what the then funding might be, knowing that long-term we will need more funding, but I don't want to lose this opportunity. The last time we had major budget reductions, what did we do? We cut programs and we cut enrollment, and we lost a generation of Oregonians. And we talked about this during the last session. The students are coming this time. We do not want to lose them. We do not want to lose another generation. That's really what Dave's report is intended to help us figure out how to deal with. That's what the other issues that the board will be dealing with and that I hope you will help us work on will be about.
Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to the end of our agenda. Unless any of you have any other... Is this week? The next date is not set for January, or are we on the 14th?
12th. 12th. In the morning.
Do we have our 12th. Committee bills? And do you know what those are?
Yes, the two bills. One is a very technical, small ESD technical fix. And the other is a placeholder on education.
Okay.
With the idea that it will be something
may come up.
Available.
Yeah. Okay, we are adjourned.
Mr. Masker.